happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage, Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time, Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough, and last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. As you hopefully know, the Fretboard Journal is in the middle of its first ever subscription drive. It took us 14 years, but we finally got here. This is our reminder to all of you out there, all of the folks who consume our podcasts or maybe our online content or enjoy the videos that we produce, that we are a reader-supported magazine and advertising is not a huge part of our general equation. And for this place to work, for us to grow, for us to get better gear and do more podcasts and more videos and more issues of the magazine and all sorts of fun stuff that we want to do, we could use your support. So go to fretboardjournal.com/support. We have a ton of different packages, but if you're listening to this and maybe you've given up on print magazines, which I totally understand, a lot of them are crap these days, give us a try by just getting a digital subscription. It's $30 for the year. You'll be helping us out in a big way. You'll get a PDF of every issue of the Fretboard Journal sent to your inbox, and you'll have like 500 pages of editorial to read every year. It sure beats a tip jar or a Patreon page for supporting this podcast. So go to fretboardjournal.com/support. You will also find videos from Bill Frisell and Ben Harper and Brian Sutton and all sorts of other Fretboard Journal past, present, and future subjects celebrating our magazine over this month. And I can't thank those guys enough for doing that. If any famous noteworthy musicians are listening to this very podcast who I don't have an email for, send me a video, be a part of our Fretboard Journal subscription drive, do a little testimonial, or just send me a performance. I would love to share it with all of our readers and listeners. All right. So I'm going to go off script here and just say that I've done about 270 interviews for the Fretboard Journal podcast. And this is my absolute favorite interview I've ever done. This is a conversation I had with TJ Thompson earlier this month. TJ has been featured on the Fretboard Journal podcast more than anyone else with this episode. He was on episode 55, 97, 122, and 123. I had to look that up. I don't have that memorized. And this conversation, which happened last week, is my all-time favorite. So what I love about TJ is he is one of the greatest guitar repair people and luthiers and guitar makers alive today, but he also has this human element, and you're going to hear all about it. And we're not just geeking out on old Martin serial numbers in this conversation. We're talking about life, and really that's what I love to do. It's why the Fretboard Journal exists, to have real conversations with musicians and makers that go beyond just specs and press releases and all the BS that you can read about everywhere else under the sun. So thank you, TJ, for taking a couple hours out of your time to have this conversation and for being so open. I hope you guys all enjoy it. As I said earlier, the Fretboard Journal exists thanks to subscribers such as yourself, but we also have a couple of advertisers who get what we are all about and want to help us out in a big way. First up is Mono Cases, who help us out in so many different ways. They sponsor our mailers for the print magazine and all sorts of other stuff. I rock the Mono Vertigo case for my Telecaster. It's my favorite gig bag ever. I know a lot of acoustic guitar players love the Mono Classic case. You can go to monocreators.com, see their entire lineup. I swear by these guys. They even have gig bags for pedal boards now. They have all sorts of stuff. Monocreators.com. Our other sponsor is Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in Brooklyn. They've been longtime sponsors to the Fretboard Journal podcast. We're talking all about old Martins on this podcast with TJ, and they have a bunch right now, including a 38 00018, a 67 D18, and a 27 Martin 042. You don't see those too often. They also have what looks to be a beautiful sunburst and supposedly lightweight 61 Gibson ES-335. And I like the quirky stuff. They have a 1965 Burns Baby Bison, which would be the guitar I'd grab if I walked over to the new Retrofret showroom. I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. Thank you so much. Keep the feedback coming. Share it with your friends if you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And again, thanks for supporting the Fretboard Journal subscription drive in advance. Here's my conversation with TJ. I will say we cover a lot of ground. The reason we are talking about Charo is because when TJ texted me to confirm the time for this interview, instead of texting him back, sounds great, I just texted him a GIF of Charo dancing across the stage. And that is what set the tone for this interview. Enjoy. Did Charo have much of an influence on you as an aspiring guitarist?
Well, I loved her for so many reasons. and I think I mentioned to you that it was always awkward and a little uncomfortable when she would come on the television and I was sitting there eating dinner with my grandmother. I grew up with my grandmother, so she probably didn't want me seeing her shaking her booty on television.
I think you were one of millions of children in America all the way up through the 80s who were feeling uncomfortable with their parents or grandparents.
Oh, okay. It wasn't just me, huh?
No.
Well, I've never discussed it with anyone else, but...
All right.
But yeah, I really... I mean, I always enjoyed when she came on the television. I think I mentioned to you that she used to watch Medical Center with Chad Everett. And it's funny to think about those times now because, I mean, I didn't know what was going on, obviously, but she clearly had a crush on Chad Everett. Like, why is she watching this medical show? She didn't have a background in medicine. And then I told you that Steve Krieger introduced me to that guy in his local grocery store.
It all comes full circle thanks to guitars.
It was so fun. I wish my grandmother had been around so I could call her and tell her I met Chad Everett.
Yeah. What years were you raised by your grandmother?
Oh, let's see. I moved in with her when I was a sophomore in high school, freshman in high school. I think sophomore. And then I lived there until I was about 18.
So that's high school. That's a pivotal time in your life when you're exploring music and girls and everything. Was it awkward being raised by your grandmother?
You know, that's a good question. I should think more about that. I mean, I've certainly thought about it in therapy over the years of it. I adored her. She was just my favorite person on the planet, and she felt that way about me, too, from the time I was a little kid. For some reason, we just really had a connection. I still don't know exactly what that's about, but you know, I have two sisters, one older, 2 years older, and one 2 years younger, and they just never really clicked in the same way, so... So when my family fell apart, my parents were both drinkers, and that's not a good place for kids.
No.
And they just kind of fell apart at some point, and my grandmother said, "You're moving in with me." And my sisters had already sort of found other places to go, and I was just delighted because my grandmother lived... I grew up in this town called Granville, Ohio. And my grandmother lived right in the middle of the town, and it was just the coolest thing. I had nothing going on in my life that was cool up to that point because we lived out in the country. We lived on a farm, and, you know, I'd have to ride the bus to school, and the whole thing was just kind of embarrassing for me. And so when I got to move in town, I mean, I wasn't happy about the family falling apart, but moving into town was just the coolest thing. All of a sudden, I just felt like I was cool. And then I got a jean jacket, and I was like barking at the big dogs.
Yeah.
And I could walk to school. That was the other thing. I didn't have to ride the bus. So I would walk over Denison University campus. Denison University is right in the middle of this town. And so I would walk over the college campus and look at those students and think, God, they're old. They seem so old.
Well, that's,
I couldn't imagine ever being that old.
Yeah. I have to imagine as an awkward, you know, high schooler who's just glad to not be riding the bus, being able to walk through a college campus must boost your ego a little bit or make you feel a little better.
Yeah, it was a beautiful campus, too. Do you know about Denison University?
I know nothing about Denison, no.
Well, it's kind of like a mini Ivy League school. I mean, there are a few thousand students there. But it's just such a gorgeous campus, and it really transforms this town when the students come back to it. It was really cool having the university right there, and I would walk right through the student union, which was just, I mean, so weird to think back now, but people were buying cigarettes and cigarette machines, right? I mean, they had,
sure,
they had cigarette machines right in the student union. That didn't interest me, but you could also buy butterscotch sundaes, which,
okay,
that did interest me, and so I would stop on occasion and get one of those. You could kind of act like, you know, you couldn't really pass for a college kid, but you could try to act like it. So I had some great times there.
You were getting the, what is it, the freshman 15, even though you were in high school, by stopping and getting the ice cream.
Right. Well, I had friends in high school who were super smart and were taking classes at the university. So, you know, they sort of tested through all of the math classes in high school, and then were going to the college. So it wasn't unheard of to have us little rugrats crawling around there.
Did you have a guitar at this stage in your life in high school?
Oh yeah, I did. I started, let's see, the first guitar I had, I think I must have been five, maybe four and a half. My dad's buddy stopped over with this big red, it was probably, thinking back, it was a Gibson or a Gretsch, semi-hollow body, F-hole guitar. And I was stunned. I mean, that was like the moment that my life changed, even at 5 years old. I was mesmerized by this thing. And we realized that the guy's supposed to plug it in. There was no amplifier. My dad was an electrical engineer, so he rigged up something that and was able to plug the guitar into our stereo. So then the guy started playing it, and I just couldn't get over the sounds coming out of that thing. It was so beautiful. So that's kind of how it all started, and that's how the seed got planted. And then I think about 4 years later, one of my dad's friends gave me, it was probably Silvertone, you know, one of those super cheap Sears guitars with a painted top. But I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And this guy could tell, and none of his kids had any interest in it, so he gave it to me. And it didn't have any strings on it, so I took it home. And my dad was into fishing. He had a lot of fishing gear around. And so I put two strings, the top strings, with fishing line. I used some of his high-test fishing line. And I played on two strings for a long time. It's incredible how many different tunes you can play on two strings if that's all you have.
Yeah.
But that's how it started. And I think I was probably nine then. And then I became even better friends with my old buddy Dan. And he had four brothers who were all older than him and off to college. He was much younger. And so when they would come back from college, they would bring their guitars. They were all musicians, pianists and guitar players. And they would teach him songs, and then he would teach me songs. So we would try to find guitars at yard sales and stuff. And getting back to the answer to your question of, did I have a guitar? Not only did I have one, but I started repairing them when I was probably about 12.
Yeah.
If you count stripping finish as repairing, we would buy these guitars and then break Coke bottles and use the heavy glass as scrapers and scrape the finish off. I mean, luckily we weren't scraping finish off of anything of value, but we sure had fun. And then we would try to make them playable, which of course we had no idea what we were doing. But as time went on and I got more able to work on guitars, I was fixing guitars for my friends in high school. I'd forgotten about that, and then a buddy of mine who was a trained classical guitarist reminded me that my grandfather's shop, I had stuff hanging up in there and torn into pieces, like I had necks off of guitars, all kinds of stuff. But I'd sort of forgotten about that. It was a different time, you know. I wasn't thinking of it as fixing guitars. I was probably breaking them as much as I was fixing them, but I was certainly familiarizing myself with them and getting to know the pieces and parts. There were no videos, there were no books. That happened later. I went to college to study child development, and I used to go into music stores whenever I could, and I found this book by, I think is it Hideo Kamimoto or something? Mm-hmm. And it was just a paperback kind of manual with photos in it. I never really read it, but I just looked at those pictures over and over, and I mean, now I still, those images are still burned in my mind, and luckily I don't follow any of those procedures because there's some horrible stuff going on in there. But but it was the only thing that was available at the time. I would come home from my teaching job and just scour through that book over and over. And then I started cutting inlays, saved up a bunch of money and bought a Lorenzi guitar and started putting inlays in it. So I wonder where that guitar is today. But that's kind of how it started for me. And then the next step in that evolution is I knew about Martin. And I used to go in the music stores and pick up the pamphlets, but they were just unattainable. Of course, that was the height of the worst guitars they ever made, but I didn't know. They just said Martin on the picket. They were all shiny, and they cost a lot of money. And so later on, when I had a good teaching job and I was able to save some money, I would scour through the, what did they call them? The classified. That's right. Yeah, it's been so long since I looked at a classified.
You just say Craigslist now, yeah.
This 1972 D35 popped up on there, and the guy wanted $850, I think. And so I saved up all my money, and I went and bought it, and I was just so excited to finally own that Dream Martin. Found out it had some problems. I mean, it looked like new. In fact, it was like new, but I was playing music with a flautist at the time, and she was frustrated. I could hear it too, but I couldn't imagine that my guitar could be the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But she could imagine, because she didn't know anything about Martin guitars or really care. It didn't occur to me that my guitar could be the issue. And then
it's never the
flute. I had the same problem with the pianist, right? When I would play along with the piano, I could get it in tune in one chord, but then I would change to another key and it was out of tune. And it turns out that you know, my bridge was in the wrong place, like all the others. And that brings us up to how I ended up where I am to some degree, because that's how I met Dana Bourgeois. I had moved, I was living in Maine, and I'd heard about Dana, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just get this guitar looked at. And he kind of knew what the problem was. He said, yeah, these saddles are all in the wrong place, the bridge is in the wrong place, but I can improve it by moving the saddle. So that's how I first met Dana. And he moved the saddle as much as he could. I knew that something was, you know, that the guitar was more enjoyable to play. And at that point, I was sort of miffed and burned because I had to face the fact that my dream guitar was flawed, and now it was altered. So that's kind of what started me finally down this path of away from teaching and into guitar repair and construction. It had been in my bones and blood for a long, long time, and so I finally got up the gumption to ask Dana if he would consider taking on an apprentice. And he said, well, I've never had one, but why don't you come on Thursday and we'll talk about it. And that was it. I think I was there the next day, and I was there for over 3 years until I moved to Elderly Instruments. And Dana's poor wife, I mean, his shop was in his basement at the time, and I would be down there for, I don't know, 16, 18 hours. I just could not get enough of it. I did not want to go home. And she would yell down at night, TJ, it's time to go home now. You know, it'd be 10 o'clock. You know, I'd try to not run the machinery at that hour, but they were super generous and understanding and accommodating. I think back on it. But, I mean, when you're doing what you love, it's like, it's not work, really. And it always felt that way to me from the very beginning. I just could not get enough of it.
I have so many questions right now. One of which is, when you were back in high school repairing your friends' guitars, did any good ones cross your bench? Like, did any friends have a Martin or a Fender or a Gibson or anything that today might be deemed collectible?
No, I didn't know the brands of any guitars except Martin, really. And I knew of Gibson because my grandfather played a Gibson. He used to play at square dances. I remember hearing him play a little bit. And then later, when I got into guitars, I asked my grandmother about that guitar, and she said she had sold it at a yard sale for $35. So, yeah, so I knew it was in the town of Granville somewhere, so I actually tracked it down.
Wow.
And I found it. I found the family. She remembered the name of the people who bought it because it was a small town and everybody knew everyone. And so I called them and they said, yeah, they had it, but they would, you know, never sell it. So, but yeah, so it was kind of in my veins before I was born. I mean, my grandfather taught my father to play guitar, and and he didn't really develop it, but he could certainly play some chords and a few tunes, and I always enjoyed hearing him do that. My grandmother was a violinist at church, so that was fun. We would play, she would play her violin, and I would play my guitar.
And the other thing that I wanted to ask you about is the Laprinzi, which, you know, nobody really talks about them anymore, but how did you stumble upon that guitar, and was the Martin, did it feel light years better, even though it couldn't stay in tune?
Well, you know, I didn't have the Martin then. The Laprinzi was the first real guitar I owned. I had cheap guitars, you know, just really sort of the silver tone stuff. I had a Cort 12 string, and I had a Agostino. It was a classical guitar that I put steel strings on.
Okay.
You know, which turns out was really a great idea. I mean, of course, it ruins the guitar, but it sounds so good.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the sound that came out of that guitar. I probably would today. It was really a lot of fun to play. So I put steel strings on that thing. And I'm sure, you know, if I could see that guitar now, I would wonder how I ever played anything on it, because I'm sure it was unplayable.
And how did you find that Laprinzi, though? Was it were they just everywhere?
Oh, I was living in Bangor, Maine at the time, and the music store was called... I can't think of the name of it right now, but it was a nice music store. I don't think they had Martins in there, so they had instruments like the Laprinzi in its place. Somebody else, there was some other Martin dealer nearby, I think, so they didn't have that, but they were super nice guys. They kind of just talked me through it and told me what was special about it and where it was made and who the guy was, and it's like, oh, that's pretty cool. So, I mean, I think that guitar was probably $500. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was sort of the stepping stone to the D35. Fast forward to a few years later, I would walk by the Music Emporium, which was in Porter Square in Cambridge, and I would just go in and look around, and got to be buddies with the sales guy, who turns out was Eric Schoenberg, and we would just chat. He was super nice, really friendly, and one day he said, So what's your plan with the guitar? Like, how do you plan to sort of grow your skills and develop or whatever? And I said, I don't know, I've never had a lesson. I just, you know, learn from buddy. And I said, I thought about taking lessons. And he said, oh, I give lessons. And so I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, just around the corner. He was like less than a block away. So I started going to his house. I took my D35. Uh-huh. And I felt so bad for him, because he was sitting there playing these beat up old guitars. I mean, they didn't even say Martin on them. I couldn't see Martin because they had like Pearl and the Pegheads. But I was absolutely floored by the tone that was coming out of these guitars, and his playing was just so beautiful. So there I went from kind of my living room entertaining myself and hacking around with my buddies to being in Eric Schoenberg's living room, listening to him play the nicest Martins. I mean, he, even at that time, this was probably in 1981, he had called through guitar after guitar and had the best sounding guitars. And those are the ones I was sitting there listening to him noodle around on.
Incredible.
So, I mean, it was just, yeah, it really was. So Eric and I were buddies before the connection with Dana. So it really makes you think this stuff isn't by accident. There's just no way this stuff could have happened accidentally.
I was going to say, like, by sheer accident, you just found all the right people to get to where you are today.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I had gone into other luthier shops. I didn't know how to break into it. There was no, you had to do an apprenticeship. There were no books or videos. So I remember going into a violin shop. Said, yeah, you young guys come in here and think you're going to learn this overnight. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. So I went back out and I thought, that's it. You know, this I'll never find a way to get this luthier thing off the ground. And so I had given up hope of ever making that a reality. And then the thing with Dana presented itself, and he said, yeah. So that's kind of how it started. And it was really cool to be friends with Eric already. And he was friends with Dana. And Eric is the guy who suggested, yeah, no doubt, he's the guy who suggested, you know, these guitars have intonation issues. I was like, really? Uh-oh. So he had told me about Dana. Later I met him, and we just kind of worked out the repair. And then I got up the courage to ask him about an apprenticeship. And lucky for me, he said yes.
The rest is history.
Yeah, well, I mean, that thing about about not leaving, you know, and just being there until as late as they would allow me to be. I had a tremendous interest in this, and apparently a knack for it too, because in a short time, Stan Werben had called and was looking for a repairman to take over Bart Ryder's position at Elderly, and I went out and interviewed him. And that was another incredible chapter because I worked on everything under the sun.
Of course.
Because it's not just limited to guitars. They have every type of instrument coming through the shop. I still feel the same way. I mean, I still am out here every night until midnight.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it. You know, one thing that I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up is, you know, we've written about you. You've been on this podcast before a couple times. It's one thing to read about, a lot of the rare Martins go through TJ, you know, TJ's the guy for this or that, or, you know, you're endorsed by plenty of people. Your reputation is as good as it gets. But the other day you posted on Facebook or Instagram or both of them, kind of a walkthrough of one of the repairs you did, and to see it up close, you know which one I'm talking about, I'm sure, that crushed Martin.
Oh, right.
You know, I wish you'd post every single day, but you've got guitars to fix, so I totally understand. But yeah. Just as a snapshot of what level you're working at, it was really eye-opening, I think, for a lot of us to go like, oh, that is why TJ and some of the guys who have the reputation you do have that reputation, because I don't think most of us could even wrap our heads around what you did. Could you describe what I'm talking about, sort of?
Mm-hmm. I think you might be the guy who called it the next level repair, which I kind of chuckled about because I'm thinking about posting what I think is the next level. I mean, in that case, the wood was there.
Okay.
So that's like kid stuff compared to when the wood is gone.
Okay.
That can be a nightmare.
I'll post a link to that and look forward to the missing wood one, but describe what exactly you did there.
Well, the thing about that was really difficult was the location. So that's partly why I posted it. I thought, oh, this is, I did it just sort of partly to inspire myself to do what I almost never do, which is make the proper jigs and tooling and fixtures. I thought that would be a fun part of the post. So I made that crazy rig that went inside the body. Normally, I just reach inside with something that I shape on the end that's appropriately shaped for that particular problem, and then I push the parts out. So I'll just keep pushing them out, and then sometimes, you know, you kind of have to push past where you want them to be so that they'll relax back where they originally were.
This was a crushed side of an old Martin, a rare Martin. It was right on the shoulder, right? Or
no, it was at the end block.
The end block. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And that's what made this so nearly impossible. And that's why I decided to do the post thing with this particular one, because I knew it would inspire me to build the jig and tooling that I had envisioned for years but just never bothered to make. I never checked to see if it would actually work. I just assumed that it would, but it's not exactly lazy. It's just that to pay the bills in this business, you've got to be moving. Mm-hmm. And making a jig that I'll never use again, that's why at some point in that post I said, if there's anyone else with this problem, please let me know and I'll ship it out to you, because I'll never use this again. It's for that one specific area at the end block on a dreadnought guitar on that one side. But that's the other reason I posted it, was so other people would be aware of it. But I rarely, rarely take time to do that, because there was no such thing as posting before. That's a recent phenomenon. So now I could share that jig. But in the past, you would spend, I probably spent a couple hours making that thing, maybe a few hours. And you have to dream it up. And that was not necessarily the hard part. The worst part is it doesn't mean it's going to work. Just because you dreamed it up and made it, it doesn't mean it's going to do what you want. So maybe 30% of the time that happens. When I do make the tooling and fixtures, it doesn't even do what I envisioned. It just can't. There's some reason, there's some problem that, you know, you just can't get it in position that you want without creating other problems. There's usually some reason why it just isn't going to work. I started to say that the other reason I posted this, and the thing that made it so difficult other than the location, is it was broken 4 inches across the grain. And that's the worst case. You know, that can just deem it useless. So it's really hard to fix that. I mean, I knew I would need a ton of force. It's probably more like 500 pounds of force to try to push it back. Because you got to push it back a little bit farther than you want it so that, you know, you glue it in place and then it relaxes back to where it originally was. So I took a tracing of the outside of the guitar right in that area. And then I subtracted the width of the sides. Then, you know, I'm trying to visualize how this is going to go in the guitar because you can't see any of this. But then I had to subtract the width of the lining right on the top and the back.
Of course.
I wanted to get it so that it would just kind of drop into that space. And so that's what I did. I spent some time fitting it so that it would drop in right between the linings. And then I had to figure out how I was going to hold it in place. So that's where I came up with the metal thing. So I bent a thin piece of metal and bent the ends around and then wrapped it. So I sort of effectively wrapped it. And I also spray glued it in place. And so it would stay on there. And then I know I could use the strong magnets on the outside. So I'm pushing it on the inside and forcing the broken pieces of wood back out. And then when I got it to where I wanted it, I could align the ones that stuck out farther than I wanted on the outside with the magnets that would attach to the metal plate that I bent on that jig. So I don't know if that makes sense describing it, but the other thing that's in that photo that may not have been clear to people is there's a piece of mahogany. There's a strip on the bottom of that form, and that's the height of the lining. So that's what raised it up, right? So it sort of jacked it up so that when I pushed it, I knew it would go right into place at the right height. I didn't have to try to reach in there and juggle that around. And then I put a magnet right in the middle of that fixture, of that form. And then I put a magnet on the end of the block of wood on the turnbuckle so that they would automatically align, right? So it went exactly where I wanted it to go. And then I just started cranking the turnbuckle. I had it pressed up against the neck block, which was the most solid thing at that end of the guitar. And I just worked it back out. But I mean, that's really hard to do in that spot. That's kind of what made that repair difficult. It was just that particular location. But when the wood is missing, you're really talking about art. And that was the other thing that I studied in school. I was an honor student in art, which turned out to be super handy in going into this as a career, because understanding color and form is I don't know how you do this without that stuff. I was thinking about this thing that happened in my life the other day. I'll tell you what got me thinking about it, because when my old buddy Joe Glazer came to visit one time, he was here for a couple of days or something. At some point he said, TJ, you probably think you're pretty normal, don't you? And I was like, yeah, I think so. And he started laughing and he said, you can tell from 10 feet away you're not a normal guy. And I wasn't sure how to take it. I thought, well, it seemed like, you know, I would be able to spin this into a compliment somehow. And I did. I just sort of figured, well, what does he mean by that? And then I started realizing, like, just incident after incident that just clicked into place, and I realized what he was talking about, because all those dots just sort of connected. And one of those was when I was in college, one of those Myers-Briggs test guys came around and issued one of those tests to students, and he came over to my work area, and he just kind of looked concerned, and then he just sort of said, I'm sorry. And I was like, what the hell? What's going on? And then he explained to me that this is just really unusual, that I had this thing, I think it was called a wedge or something, where there was, I only had abilities in like two areas. One was intuition and the other was creativity. And that was it. I had nothing else. He said, I'm sorry, I don't know how to advise you. And so that happened, and I realized, well, that's probably kind of what Joe was referring to.
That's a little scary, you know, that was, to hear that.
It was. It was kind of like Joe's comment, you know? I'm like, well, what does that mean? And what, I mean, luckily I found something I could do with myself and make myself useful. And, I mean, you calling me again is kind of proof to me that, you know, if you do something meaningful with your life and you work hard, that maybe someday, there's no guarantee, but maybe someday someone will call you up and they want to know what you're thinking and your opinion about something. And here you are calling me again asking for my opinion. So
I'll call you every week if you want me to. I'm trying to not distract you from the piles of guitars you got to work on.
I do have a lot of stuff to do around here. Yeah, that's for sure.
But, I mean, since we're on this tangent, this personality type that you have, where you dove headfirst into guitars, you must have this about other facets of your life as well. What else are you, like, so in the weeds on? Is there anything else besides music?
Just people.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I care about people more than I do guitars, which is a weird mix, right? Because at least in the old days, I think things have changed now, but the old, I guess I'm old enough now to call it the old days,
you
but,
can reflect.
But sort of the old guard luthier guys, they were sort of a grumpy bunch. I didn't enjoy going to shows. I pretty much avoided them. I did this sort of thing where you kind of put your head down and just try not to get eaten by the creatures around you. I mean, that's kind of what I was doing, I think, keeping the lowest of profiles possible. I still do that, but you have sort of brought into my life this sort of mini existential crisis, because it was easy to do before, because nobody was really doing what you do on the scale that you do. You just can't be ignored. You guys, you know, you care about greatness, and I was never interested in, like, yakking with people who didn't. You know, or they were just trying to sell a product, but you really care about this stuff, and it's clear. And so I couldn't just ignore you. And I knew, since my buddy Mark Stutman was, like, you know, pals with you guys and supportive, I thought, because Mark is like, he's one of those bullshit tester guys. It's really hard to be honest and not hurt people's feelings or not piss people off, or I've been able to avoid that all these years by just not talking to people like you, but I can't ignore you.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah, it's a compliment like the one Joe gave me.
Yeah.
It's like, when you're at the top of what you do, or you think about it differently maybe than normal, it's just, you know, nobody does what you guys do. So I just wasn't able to put my head down and ignore you the way I had other people's.
But how, going back to the question, how does that translate to you care about people, and so does that mean that the relationships you have with your clients, for instance, you're as interested in their lives as you are the 00028 or whatever that's in front of you, or how does that translate?
Oh, I think it's about kind of the intricacies of how relationships work. And I think music and guitars are kind of like that too. I just am interested in kind of what makes people tick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what my background was initially. Having a background in child development is really handy at times. When I have friends over here, I know they're telling me things that they've never told anyone else. I know because they tell me. And I know because I can tell by the way they feel and the way they look. Carl Rogers said, if you're having a conversation with somebody and you're bored, you're probably not getting to the truth of the matter. When you're talking about your truth and the other person is able to do that, which can take a long time. I mean, I have friends that took 10 years to get them to say what's true for them.
Sure.
Because it's hard sometimes, so... You know, I'm patient and willing to wait, and it's really rewarding. It's just been so much fun. I had a couple of dreams that I hadn't realized. One was I wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and I thought that's impossible because I grew up playing fingerstyle guitar, so that just can't happen. And the other was I wanted to have, I wouldn't call it a men's group really, but like men that I get together with and we support each other.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to what's going on, and because men are in a mess. I mean, we've been in a mess for a long time,
if I can interject, I also was raised by my grandmother and my mother, and you know, kind of grew mm-hmm. my whole life was surrounded by women, and then you sort of get past college and go like, I don't even know how to have guy friends, you know?
It's yeah, it's true. That's really true. I think that's a big part of it.
Anyways, right, keep so going.
We have that in common.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt like that was a really important thing. I felt like it was important for me, and I felt like it was important for other men. And so I tried to start a group, and I had, I don't know, 8 guys, and they all canceled except Ken Parker. Eric Schoenberg. Eric Schoenberg was my partner at the time. I mean, we were partners in Schoenberg Guitar, so I could force him to go. But Ken Parker came, and it was fantastic. I flew a guy here. We just did like a 1-day workshop, but it was just great. I mean, I still have good fond memories of that. But the story has a happy ending because as the time went on, I met more and more musicians, and we just hit it off. We really liked each other, and at some point, just the dots connected, and these guys said, "We'd like to play music with you." And I said, "What? How, what are you talking about?" So anyway, we formed a little group, and so I have a band.
Yeah, you got the rock band.
And yeah, we've been doing it for 10 years now. And, you know, the problem is, like, 10 years ago, 70s music was popular, and it took us 10 years to get up to speed, and now 80s music is popular, so we got the wrong music.
Give it another 10 years, it'll be back in vogue.
Maybe that's the solution. Yeah, because I don't feel like learning the 80s stuff. I mean, we do some of that, but mostly it's just like, they appointed me singer, so I have to pick what I know and what I can feel. That's mostly 70s stuff that I grew up on. But anyway, it's just a blast. So I got both at the same time. This is my men's group. This is the group that I wanted. It's not just music. These guys come and I sneak in the soul work. Like while we're having dinner at break time, you know, it's meaningful and important on so many levels, and none of us could give it up. It's just I look forward to it every week.
And is it all covers, or is there some original material?
Mostly covers. Yeah, stuff that I grew up singing and playing, and some stuff that the other guys brought too, but mostly stuff that I can sing and. So we've gotten to the place that I don't think we need chicken wire anymore.
That's great.
We're that good.
Yeah.
I know. Like the vocal harmony stuff, we got the drummer singing with us now, so we got 3-part harmony. It's really fun.
And are you playing guitar as well?
I play guitar, yeah.
Electric or acoustic? Guitar.
It's a Parker Fly, which sure. When I saw, I just flipped because I knew it was exactly what I wanted and needed, because it has wide spacing at the nut. And it has Larry Fishman designed piezo pickups in the bridge, so you can flip it from acoustic to electric. And I just play it in the acoustic mode through a Roland Jazz Chorus, and it sounds like $1 million. I mean, the guys in my band are just impossibly fussy. They know everything about every amplifier and every vintage electric guitar. That's not my thing, but they are really happy with the sound. So, you know, I'm misusing everything. But it's exactly the right result for this application. So the guitar player in the band, the lead player, plays a Les Paul or Strat, mm-hmm. and it's just the coolest thing. Like over the acoustic sound of the Parker Fly, through the Roland Jazz Chorus.
Incredible.
Yeah. So it's good. It's really good. So I got the band, and I got the men's group too, all in one.
Yeah, and you even brought the original men's group member's guitar into the equation, Ken Parker.
Right.
Yeah, it's all great. To switch gears a little bit, I've been doing all these interviews because we're doing a little bit of a subscription drive this month, so I'm trying to talk to my favorite people, such as yourself, and just have fun with the podcast for a month. We always have fun with it. But there's been a little recurring theme. I talked to Mark Stutman. I just talked to Andy Powers. And we've both had, in both those conversations, had conversations about, you know, workbenches and what makes a good workbench. And Mark specifically said, you need to talk to TJ about this. I was bringing this up with Mark because he's about to build one at his house. And I was just curious about the ergonomics, like what, I guess the thing I'm likening it to is like how a chef prepares his workstation. You have one of the larger workstations out of anyone I know, but what thought went into it, and how do you figure out where your, you know, basically how your office is configured?
Oh, yeah. He probably said, you need to talk to me, because I don't think it's an exaggeration to say I probably have 300 feet of benches.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And I would say that, that, you know, number one most important thing is it would, the answer would vary depending on the person's height. So you'd have to figure out your own height, and then you figure out what the optimal bench height is for you. And it would be different, you know, everyone would be different. So mine would be terrible for some people. I'm 6'1" or something, so I think I have mine at 38 inches. It might be 40, because you want to have it up where you can see what you're doing, but not so high that you can't. You got to account for the height of the guitar, the thickness of the body, so you're not reaching up over yourself. You don't want to be looking at it from the side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most benches are too low, and then people injure their backs. That's probably how Marker hurt his back. So that would be number one, and then number two would be stability. So I have 4x4 legs on the bottom of mine, so that when you're pounding or sawing, that it's not moving. It's really important to have it stable, so that all the force of the cut is going into the wood, and your bench isn't rocking, which is going to throw off your whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing I would say is just having it tricked out. I mean, Mark probably told you, sent me a picture the other day of this cool thing that he adapted on the edge of his bench, so that he could just pop this thing in and then have the peg head out, hanging out over his bench, off the edge of his bench, and supported. So he was really excited about that, and I could see why. I mean, I have enough bench spaces that I can just go to a different bench, because I might have gotten a little carried away when I designed and made my shop. So I would just carry the instrument to another workstation. But that was a cool thing that he came up with. And then I have vacuums rigged up all over mine. I have a fan above my bench, which I think is important, you know, for moving anything if you happen to be soldering, or sometimes if you're using super glue, that stuff is really noxious. So I have a fan for that. And then so between the vacuums, the fan, and then, you know, maybe worth mentioning, like, some cool carpet that inspires you. I have red carpet on my bench now because I got it at Job Lot, and it was just super cheap and kind of a just the right nap, and it's driving Mark nuts. He's like, really, you have to have that red carpet? He doesn't like it in the photos. So I said, all right. But I'm trying to wait till it gets a little more worn, because it's still pretty clean and new, and then I'll switch it out with something else so I can take photos on my bench without bugging the expert at this photography stuff.
Some hideous casino
but
carpet.
To me, well, I associate the red carpet thing with the violin world.
Yeah.
Right? And the violin world is really my reference. It has my frame of reference for this stuff has nothing to do with guitars, really. I've never read a repair book. I mean, I shouldn't tell you this, maybe, but I've never really read anything. And there's a reason for that. I mean, partly it's because I grew up when there was nothing, so I didn't have anything to read. But then I started reading stuff sometimes, and I would be like, well, that doesn't seem like, you know, it's like the idea is a virus, and now I'm infected. And so I didn't really want to have that information in my head. So I'd sort of clear it out and just kind of come up with my own way of doing it. And so I stopped reading anything, which is, with the posting and stuff, you can't, you kind of are forced, you know, in the photos, you can take in what's going on. But that's all new. I mean, before you'd have to buy a book or something, or a video and watch it. I just never did it because I didn't want to be influenced. I didn't want to be doing the same thing that everyone else was doing. So it's kind of funny. I mentioned that Kamamoto book, you know, that the one that I poured through the photos on, and now here I am posting my own. You know, so it's sort of funny to have gone from that, you know, my little apartment in Bangor, Maine, looking through that book to now I could have my own book.
Yeah. You could. I mean, I don't I understand where you're coming from, because when I'm writing a story for the magazine or our website or anything, I refuse to read anything because I don't want some turn of phrase or descriptor to show up in the article. And if it does through osmosis or whatever, then at least I can say it was an accident. But but you're thinking about that along the lines of guitar repair. But clearly there are some guitar repair people who you respect and admire, and it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if you guys were all doing the same thing, right?
You know, we get to the same end result, but it's fascinating to just see, oh, that's really fun to see how you got to that end. So that happens, but it doesn't make me think, oh, I wish I hadn't figured it out on my own.
It's a journey.
It never feels like it. Yeah. It doesn't feel like it was a waste of time. And then sometimes you could blend and mix the approaches. Mm-hmm. You know, that thing that I posted, that's an example. I don't know. As far as I know, no one's ever done that. One of the reasons, to go back to that for a second, one of the reasons that I made that, I didn't finish this thought, but as I was able to use that same rig to put the cloth in there, right, that's another aspect of this. It's really difficult. How do you reach all the way into the bottom of a dreadnought guitar and apply a piece of cloth so it doesn't look like it was done by a kindergartner? When people, that's just one of the worst things I've ever seen. When you see cloth inside an instrument, it's usually just horrible. And I wanted this to look like it was done with a magic wand. I knew that form would go back exactly where I wanted it. Then I could just put the cloth on. After it was all glued together and everything was done, I just reinforced it with a piece of cloth. So sorry to go back to that.
No, it looked seamless, yeah.
Yeah, if you look inside, it's just gone. It just makes it go away. You know, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I mentioned that the guys that I kind of tried to learn from were kind of a grumpy lot. Dana was an exception, but most of them were, you know, it was competitive. I mean, men can be super competitive.
Sure.
And even in, you know, I think less so now, as I say, with the social media stuff, at least everybody seems happier. But back in those days, you know, people weren't exactly happy to share techniques. I never asked anyone for anything. The only person I ever called was Michael Dresner. Do you know who that guy is?
Yeah.
Oh, he's in your town, isn't he?
Is he in my town?
He lives in Washington.
Okay.
Make a note of that name. If he's willing to do it, that would be an interesting podcast.
Yeah, it looks like he's down near Tacoma, so he's about an hour and a half from where I am. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's kind of retired now. That would be a really interesting podcast. I'd probably listen to that one.
All right. You made it sound, when I brought up the guitar that we were just talking about, that I wouldn't say... You didn't describe it as a simple repair, but you said that there are some repairs that are even far more impressive.
Oh, yeah.
So are any of those on your bench right now?
Yes, I'm working on one right now.
What is it?
OM-28, an original OM-28 with a cutaway.
Yes, I do remember this.
There's no such thing, of course. This is just very sad. I should speak of it only in solemn terms, but somebody actually cut out a section of this OM-28 and installed a cutaway. And I knew I could fix it, but I knew it wasn't going to be easy. And so that's what I've been working on. I put the cutaway back in.
Wait, what?
I put the pieces of wood back in.
So the cutaway's gone.
The guy cut out. Yeah. Yeah. So I undid it.
And can so you that, walk? I mean, this was a trippy guitar. Obviously, now people play Schoenberg soloists, and the cutaway is a desired thing for some. But this was some guy, a hillbilly perhaps, who had an idea and a vision, and maybe no sense of style or anything. Where did you buy this guitar?
These things kind of
come
my way because people say this guy was in Tennessee, I think, and a bunch of people said, you know, this should go to TJ Disjay, and he called me up a year and a half ago and said, you know, everybody tells me it should go to you, and he wanted, I don't know, $25,000, and I said, well,
this was not the guy who made who did the surgery, is it?
No.
Okay,
no.
That guy's long gone.
He bought it at a yard sale or something for next to nothing, but then he found out that, you know, it was an OM-28, and then he got these big numbers in his head like a lot of people do, and that was fine. I mean, I was more excited about it probably than anybody, just because I love those guitars. And so I really, really wanted it too, but I just had to say, you know, best of luck to you, because there's no way that anyone in their right mind would take a chance on it at that number, and that's what happened. He called me up a year later, and his tail was between his legs. He's like, I'm sorry, I would like to sell it to you. And I said, okay. And so he said, $6,000. And I said, all right, well, that's fine. I'll pay you $6,000 for it. And he said, but you can't change your mind. And I said, okay. So he shipped it, and it arrived, and I was sick because it wasn't the original top.
Oh.
Somebody had changed the top.
Is that why he said, don't change your mind?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, but I don't think so. I don't think so, because when I told him, I mean, he was crestfallen, and I, you know, he wanted the money for his daughter's college or something. So, you know, I felt bad about that, but I said, look, I can't pay you this for this. The top is not the wrong top. And no one told him. Like, mm-hmm. I think seriously, no one, or just no one knew, because it was a 40s Martin top. It was confusing. It was scalloped. It was an old top. It was just the wrong top. It wasn't an old 28 top. So I had to break that bad news to him, and he was kind of sick about it. So I said, look, I'll give you, I think, $4,000 or something. So I think I bought it for about maybe $4,500. Yeah, $4,500, I think. But bit by bit, I'm getting it back together. And with help from Mike Ruckel, I want to mention his name in this podcast. I don't know if I've mentioned him to you before. But yeah, I haven't mentioned him because he demands a lower profile than I have. Uh-oh. Over the years.
Okay.
He has three kids, and he spent most of his, you know, his time and energy raising his kids, and he just didn't want people bugging him. And but I think what happened is his kids got older. They're kind of like, Daddy, what do you do? What is it that you do? And so, you know, he lives in New Hampshire, but he comes here a couple days a week. He used to be in Massachusetts and would come in every day. Then he moved to New Hampshire, so I see him a couple days a week or something. And I don't know if you could ever get him on a podcast because he's pretty shy, but definitely worth mentioning his name. He's just an awesome human being and just a great repairman.
And a bit of so, a anyway, shadow to you, or is like, is he the next generation T.J. Thompson? Or he, how do we describe this guy?
Well, he came, when he came to call me up, he just bought a book and started making guitars in his basement. And he brought him to the shop, and they were just beautifully made, but they were like, they looked like they were copies of like harmonies or something, you know, because he just had no frame of reference. But I really liked him, and I could see a ton of potential. So you know, I sort of took him on as an apprentice, and okay. It just worked out great. He's just such a great guy. You know, it really, for me, it really is about the personality and the right person. And he just turned out to be the right guy. But yeah, he really likes his privacy. And so I haven't really mentioned him, just to keep him, you know, to keep his anonymity. But then his kid started out, I think, that's just how it started. He's like, you know, I think I'd be okay with you mentioning my name. I'm like, you bet. So I mentioned his name in a podcast, and I mentioned it to you whether he likes it or not, because he deserves it. So he's gotten to the place, like I said, Mike, this is your PhD project. I've been giving him, you know, certain aspects of this. I didn't give him the cutaway part, but the body had all kinds of other problems. You know, the lining was loose in areas. It had cracks and breaks, and he's just a master of that stuff. So he put it back together beautifully, refit some binding, you know, that was missing, or it had the wrong binding, and he took it out, replaced some perforating. It just did a beautiful job, patched in lining. So he did a bunch of the interior work too, re-glued braces, and then I started working on it. I was so psyched by the result of his input. And nothing would ever happen with this guitar probably if Mike hadn't been here. But, you know, he's gotten to the place that I can give him this advanced stuff. And it's really been fun for both of us. I you know, I think he's sort of, because I own it, I can give him stuff to sort of explore and reach out on. And it's been a success for both of us. I mean, I'm, you know, getting the stuff moving ahead that I'd never get to. And he gets to see that he's capable of this stuff that's really difficult. So hats off to him, and thank you, Mike, for helping moving this forward. I can't take all the credit for the fact that this guitar is going to play once again. So now I have to find a top. I have an OM18 top, and I'm going to try to convert the rosette to a 28. Okay. And install it on this guitar, because where else am I going to get an OM28 top? If I replace the top, you know, it's interesting, but what do I have then?
Yeah.
You know,
did this guitar come with the neck? I got to ask.
It did.
Okay, it did. It wasn't on the Instagram, so I didn't know if you just bought a body for $4,500 or if it was, the neck too.
I got the neck too, which is really what I wanted, because I knew even if I threw the body away, I'd be able to use the neck someday.
Got it.
But here's a crazy piece of that story before you got to go or whatever we're doing next year. But one of the reasons I wanted this guitar so badly is I had replaced a side on an OM 28 years ago from the same year, 1931. And I had that side, so I knew I could take a cutout from that section and graft it onto this guitar. Right, so I took a piece of another OM 28 side and patched it in where the guy cut out the section. You know, it's as much original parts as you could have. I mean, I've been storing that side. It was cracked. So
what about for the piece of the pie in the back that was cut out? What did you end up?
Well,
I don't want to spoil your future Instagram post, but
no, that's okay. I have thousands of pieces of wood. You asked me earlier, what are the ways in which your personality might be unusual? And I have saved all of these pieces for all of these years. You know, I literally have thousands of pieces of wood. So I just went through and found what I thought would be the best match. And it's pretty impressive.
Wow.
So I just found a piece of Brazilian. I mean, you can't really do this work unless you do that. I have piles of old binding, you know, that's part of the secret. You have to have the right ivroid. It's one of the reasons that I have agreed to do these conversions. I don't do it unless the top is wrecked or it needs to be taken apart for some other reason, but converting the C's, you know, the C2s and the C3s into flat top guitars. So they're some of the best guitars I've ever heard. And of course the arch tops were nothing special, but I still won't take them apart unless people call me all the time and like, you know, send me a picture. If the top is wrecked, I'll do it. But anyway, one of the reasons that I agreed to do that from the outset is because I wanted the binding.
Yeah.
Right. So I could take that part off. And that part is super valuable to me in situations like this where I'm patching it in on an OM28. It just doesn't look right without the, I'll patch it in with the original finish on it.
Sure.
So it looks like it grew there, that just makes all the difference.
When I hear you say you have thousands of pieces of wood that you've accumulated from former repairs, I think of a giant pile. I have a feeling T.J. Thompson has these organized in by year and model and in some crazy Dewey Decimal System fashion. Am I correct?
Well, kind of a mixed bag, you know. I mean, it's like, I'll have the spruce in one area. Yeah, I have the rosewood in another, and the mahogany in another. Yeah,
got it.
Yeah, you know what I'd really like to have, in case you have other builders and repair people who happen to hear this. One thing that I'm lacking in is I don't have mahogany with finish on it. So if anybody out there has a, you know, piece of mahogany back or even rosewood back, like, you know, because those bodies don't get thrown away.
Sure.
I mean, imagine how wrecked a 37 D28 would have to be for you to just call it unrestorable.
Yeah.
You know, the back would have to be really fragmented and just to be thrown away and not repaired. But I could really use some of those fragments. I just don't have the rosewood or mahogany pieces like that, because I've just never come across a guitar like that I would throw away. But maybe somebody has a back, you know, or a piece of a back or something. So anyway, that would be worth a lot to me.
What if this 30 OM28 were not a cutaway, if it were still in good condition, it'd be worth close to six figures, right?
Well, these days used to be true. It would probably be worth, you know, 60 to 80K, something like that.
Okay.
If it were in really nice shape, yeah.
If you're in this for $4,500 now, not including your copious skills, if I had bought this guitar for $4,500 and brought it to you, what would the ballpark be to do what you are going to do to it? Like, give me a range.
I wouldn't have done it. Like, okay. If you had brought
you'd
it
politely
to me,
turn me
yeah,
down.
I just, no, I, yeah, I would have to own it to do it, because this, you know, stuff at this scale, you can't estimate. I mean, I wouldn't do it because I only will take on work that the guitar is worth more after than the repair costs. And this isn't one of those. you know, you saw that post, Mark, when Mark was here, he said I forget what post that was, but he said, I stole TJ's phone. This was probably a year ago, and he posted this 018 that was crushed. I mean, it had literally been run over by a car, and I resurrected it. But, you know, that was a $20,000 repair on a guitar that's worth $5,000, you know? So, I mean, that brings up something that I was hoping to talk about a little bit, which is money.
Let's talk about it.
Well, to me, like, people come along and, you know, you see now that the internet is around, everybody's like, well, that's blah, 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 and he paid this, and this is only that. I mean, they're all comparing prices. And to me, I pay based on what it's worth to me. So here's an example. So I bought this 00018 from 1928 that was not really usable. It was so crunched, but it had the original bridge on it, and it had never been off. So that was worth almost as much as a one that wasn't damaged for that feature alone, because that is so rare. That almost doesn't happen. To me, it was like, I will build this guitar around that bridge. I mean, if you played it, you'd just be floored. It is such a great guitar. And it looks really good. You know, you can tell it's worn, but the repairs are, you know, it just looks like an old guitar. You can't tell that it had, there's no way to tell it had all those issues. They're really gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'll pay more for that stuff depending on you know, what it is that draws me, you know, something like that, that the fact that the bridge had never been off. I'll make a guitar around it. I sell vintage guitars, but nobody really knows it because I don't tell anyone. So if people come in my shop and they see something hanging on the wall and it moves them, or they, you know, they're interested, they're like, oh, what's that? Could I try it? And they try it and fall in love with it. And then they ask me about it. Then I say, it's for sale. But that's how I sell things. And my clients understand that. I say, yeah, you can hang it on the wall here, but I'm not going to talk about it or advertise it. If somebody comes in and asks me about it, that's a connection. You know, for me to have to make that call and say, you know, I have this, and it, you know, it's best if the person calls you looking for it. So that's how I sell stuff. But, you know, to me, it's like, if I price, you know, the real price on that 018 that was crushed. So now you have an instrument that was not usable. Everyone had deemed it unrepairable. I put it back together. It's beautiful. It plays like $1 million. It sounds great. To me, it's worth $21,600. I bought it on eBay for $1,600 12 years ago, run over by a car. I couldn't use anything. The bridge had been cut down. The pickguard was too small for any other guitar. They're weird tuners from 1932. Nobody else would. There was just nothing usable on it. Short scale neck. I just decided I'd have a go at it and restore it. But, you know, I should sell that guitar for $21,600.
How did the six come into play?
Because I paid $1,600 for it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's how much I bought it for on eBay. And then I put $20,000 in the repair.
Got it.
So to get my money back, I've got to sell it for $21,600. So when I see those blogs, you know, people are like, well, I paid this, he's charging that. It's just meaningless yammering to me. I understand why people do it, because they want to feel like, you know, they have some control over this, they're getting the best deal, the best price, all of that stuff. But there are factors going on in some of these cases that can't really be so easily quantified. It's a functional piece of art.
Sure.
It was broken beyond repair, and now it's been restored and resurrected. So the problem with this equation, obviously, is nobody wants to pay for that. And that's why I never worked on O's. This is the first, well, it's the second, probably the second O that I've worked on. And I love those guitars. They're just littler. They're every bit as cool. But yeah. you can't repair them because no one wants to pay for it. So they just keep getting bad repairs year after year. They've come up in value now, so it's possible to fix them. But I just feel bad for those guitars. They've gotten bad service over the years. And so I just decided to give this one new life. But to get my money back, I'd have to sell it for over $20,000. So, I mean, I just don't think people have any idea that's the reality behind some of these projects and numbers. It can be fixed, but that's why I don't work on the cheaper guitars. I only work on the really nice stuff because I want it to be a win-win. I don't want to be the guy who's charging more than anyone else. You know, yeah. But if I paid $22,000 for it, and then I put $3,000 repairs in it, I got $25,000 in that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm going to sell it like playing like $1 million, totally repaired. So, you know, I feel like I can kind of charge for that, and most of my clients agree and understand. But that's just a strange aspect of this business to me. You know, that the money part of it, when people start talking about money, I get why they're doing it, and you know, it seems like a lot of money, but I don't think about them like just a guitar at that point. I think about it like more like a homeless kid,
yeah,
that you took off the street and adopted.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
You know, with its own personality.
Yeah,
people talking about guitars like they're pieces. I don't even want to say pieces of meat. That's not fair, especially to say to a vegan. But so like they're just, you know, stamped out of a mold. They're not stamped out of a mold. They're all completely different. So I want people to value them and respect them for their individual attributes that they're bringing to the party.
Yeah. What does the future hold for this cutaway guitar? Is it one day going to be one of these soft sale guitars hanging on your wall, or are you just going to keep it as a memento?
Yeah.
It is. Okay.
Probably. Probably. I mean, either that or it will be my Beach OM-28. You know, that would make a great...
You'll be the only one.
Can you have a Beach OM-28? But it really is going to come down to the success or failure of switching the rosette in the 18 top. Right? If I can switch it to the 28 style successfully, that's a really difficult thing to do. But I'm hoping to be able to convert this rosette to the 28 style, and then it will go on this body. I actually bought it for an 18, but here's a little known fact. I think I actually spilled this fact at my talk at your Fretboard Journal Summit. Although I'm not sure, maybe I didn't get to it. I ran out of time, but it turns out, you know, you see these measurements in books. The OM is this wide, the O is this wide, the double O is this wide. I mean, I've seen OMs that were 3/16 of an inch under spec,
okay,
and an 1/8 of an inch over spec.
That's a range.
So that's a huge range. And the reason that I tell you, I mean, this gets back to what I said about personality. They're made by hand, and they all respond differently. Of course, one that is 3/16 under spec is going to respond really differently than one that's an 1/8 of an inch over spec.
It's crazy.
But the reason I mention that is because I bought this OM-18 top expecting to put it on an OM-18 body that I have that has no top, and it won't work because the body is much bigger than the top that I bought. Oh.
Throw it in the dryer. Yeah.
I'm telling you, they're not stamped out. It's cookie cutter stamps. It's just not the case. They're all so different, but it happens to fit on the OM-28 body. So that's why I was like, oh, I couldn't work this rosette and try to bring it back to life in that way, but I can't use it on the OM-18 body. You know, the herringbone gives you a little more leeway because it's wider than the purfling on the 18 style.
Sure. So when is the momentous day? How do you prepare for this, the OM-18 conversion top, the OM-18 top conversion? Is this something that you think about, let the wheels in your head stew over for months and months, and then you give yourself a date where it's like, this is when I tackle it? Or is it at 11:30 at night when it's just the, you know, inspiration hits and you're like, all right, now's the time?
I think it's a combination of inspiration and just trusting something else in charge other than just my little brain telling me what the right time is. And you know, when I move to do it, it just seems to happen. I can't really force it. Sometimes if you wait longer, you'll get a better idea. I seem to work this stuff out in my sleep. Like I'll wake up in the morning and I'll have this new idea, new approach, new way to tackle something. It seems to happen all the time. And that's really fun because if you can get work done while you're sleeping, you're really making tracks.
When it's a client's guitar, most of your clients, I imagine, are patient and know that you have an extremely long lead time for these things. But do you then kind of have to light a little fire under yourself of like, hey, I need to turn this thing around. It's been sitting here for X number of weeks or months.
Well, most things turn around pretty quickly. I prioritize the repair stuff, which is why I never seem to get to my new builds, much to the chagrin of my clients who are waiting. The repair stuff keeps coming, you know, like that thing that I posted. That's an example. But what happens is it's largely decided by that particular client. So the guy who had the D18 is a performing musician. I just busted it out of here because he was wanting to have it for a tour coming up. So, you know, so that's a huge part of it. If somebody brings something in and they say, look, I don't care when I get it, then I can let it sit around longer. But it just depends on the scope and the scale of what's needed. And that's why the other reason I said I wouldn't take it on. If you had brought me that OM28, with a cutaway, you know, it's one of those projects that is so demanding and stuff that I kind of need to just own it. It's really a labor of love. But if you said, look, it's got sentimental value, I don't care what it costs, and I don't care when you get to it, I would take it. I would have done it in that situation. And then I could give them a realistic number at the end because I keep track of roughly of the time. But there's no way to know up front because you just don't know what the last person did until you get in there. You don't know if it's epoxy, you know, I mean, and when you're looking at a cutaway, you know, God only knows what you'll find in there. Somebody was you know, nutty enough to do that to that guitar. No, all bets are off. Anything possible.
Do you know the most expensive repair you've ever had to charge for?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was in the high 20s, like 28,000.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, those numbers have to be adjusted for inflation. It depends on when that was. But yeah, I mean, I've kind of gotten to the place where I just try to take on less of that stuff because it's not fair to my clients who are waiting for new guitars. So I try not to take on those massive projects. You know, there's a D45 that's floating around that a couple of people have asked me to take on, and it's a basket case. It's just not fair to my clients who are waiting for new guitars. So I take on the smaller stuff like that crushed inside that you saw, you know, and I probably did that in less than, I don't know, 15 or 20 hours total, something like that.
Wow. Did the musician, you don't have to name him, did he cause that or she?
Well, somebody else asked me that, and I said, I've never asked anyone. It just seemed kind of personal.
Okay.
You know, you know, if you were a doctor and someone came in and said, you know, they had an STD, the doctor probably wouldn't say, how did you get it? It seemed like that to me. Like, you better not ask. I mean, it usually has to do with a jilted lover or some stupid thing like knocked it off the stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they've been humiliated enough. So I don't think I've ever asked, but it would make a good story. That's for sure.
And with a guitar I was going to say, with a guitar like that, and what I'm guessing is a pretty capable musician, if they're touring, needed it back. They knew what it was like before. They got it after. Aside from the visuals, was there any tonal difference after that repair to them or to you?
Well, he hasn't picked it up yet.
Oh, he hasn't picked it up yet, so we don't know. Okay.
Yeah, no, I've just been kind of keeping an eye on it, making sure it's all stable and everything. But he's supposed to pick it up this week.
All right.
And, of course, I didn't play it before because you couldn't string it up, so sure. I wouldn't know. But somebody else asked me that in the post, and I said, no way that what I did in that section of the guitar is going to affect the sound of it negatively.
Sure.
That wasn't a concern of mine at all. I'm unlikely to take on a repair that I know when it's done, it's going to sound worse. Mm-hmm. I only want to do repairs that are going to sound just as good or better. Because to me, sound is number one. It's like, it's top on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've been talking a while. You have work to do, including new guitars to make.
Yeah.
But
I'm so sorry to go on and on again.
No. You could go on all day and I'd keep it recording.
These poor people, I feel so bad for them.
Are you kidding me? They love
this
stuff.
Maybe you could play it at double speed. You could speed it up.
You can do that with podcasts, yeah.
All right, yeah.
Since we kind of went into a philosophical mode for a while here, and we're talking about life and life beyond guitars, is there anything you'd like to pursue career-wise or non-career-wise in the next 10 years that you're not doing right now?
Oh, since we're talking about truth, I would not go into this field today if I had it to do over again. I just feel like we're tripping over guitars. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do this. I really wanted to do it because I wanted to see if I could make guitars that could rival what I heard coming out of Eric Schoenberg's old Martins. That really just got kind of emblazoned in my brain and soul, and that's what I wanted to do. And I was sitting there with my D35 playing it in front of him, playing those old Martins. It's like, oh, there's so many guitars. I just feel like, oh, you know, back then, great guitars were rare, and now great guitars are everywhere, which is kind of cool. But now I'm already in this field, and I would go into pediatric surgery or something. I mean, I was up a bunch in the night thinking about if I were choosing a profession now, I would work to solve these. Can I swear on this?
Yeah. It's amazing we haven't yet. Yeah.
Yeah, like effing a-holes who go into schools and shoot up children, mm-hmm. right? I would be working towards finding, I can envision systems that would stop that. You know, that's what I do in my work. That's what I'm doing on these guitars. I'm putting all of this energy and effort into fixing like a crushed side. You know, it's fun. It's rewarding. It's artistic. It's also selfish in a way. You know, it's like, okay, it's fun. Here you go. You know, I get this money. I can pay my bills the way I want to pay my bills. But, you know, the world's changing. You know, there are other things that going on in the world that I could be spending my time and attention on. That's probably what I would do. I wanted to build guitars because of the demand. There was a tremendous need for them. And now I just feel like, you know, if you take 1,000 of the handmade guitars that are made this year, I guarantee you 10% of them I would love. 100 of them will be incredible. Mm-hmm. And that's unprecedented. That's never been the case. So I feel like, what am I doing? You know, I'm trying to stay a step ahead in terms of like inspiring myself. I have to be doing something. I always said to myself, I'll stop. If somebody else is doing this, I'll stop. And people are getting close. They're really close. They're right on my heels. You know, they're almost doing what I do. But I have to just keep like taking it up a notch. And it's just crazy. Like, I don't even care about some of this stuff, but I don't have a choice. I've got to keep dialing it up to the next level to stay ahead of these guys. I probably wouldn't go into this, and it would be a tremendous loss for me because I love it so much. But I would be doing something like solving the problem with gun violence. If a bunch of my luthier friends and I got together, we could come up with solutions. We're fixing guitars. We're designing guitar stuff. That's cool, but there's other stuff going on in the world. You know, I don't want to look at it either sometimes, but I picked this career partly because I could kind of keep my head down and try not to get eaten. But at some point, you know, I got to peek out and say, well, what else is going on here? And when I peek out, that's what I see. You know, I see stuff that I would probably be solving other than just broken guitars. That's what I was trying to avoid saying.
No, I mean, with your mind, I hope that you are able to carve out some time for some of this extracurricular stuff at some point. It sounds, I'd love to hear where it would go.
It's kind of a call to not arms. I'd love to get together with, because a lot of these luthier folks are really, really great problem solvers. You know, that's the number one thing that keeps me coming back. It is so fun solving these problems.
Yeah.
You know, it's my version of the crossword. Everyone is different, and it's just a blast figuring it out. But yeah, I mean, at some point it would be really incredible to just like get a bunch of these luthier minds together and work on some of these other issues. You know, let's solve some of these other problems. The reason I know about these things is my girlfriend moved in. She watches the news.
Yes.
And I make every effort to not hear the news. And then I go up to the house and she's like, oh, did you hear? I'm like, please don't tell me. Yes, I know. Please don't tell me. No, don't. It's that virus thing, right? It's
yeah.
that being infected by that virus, it can wreck my week. It's that powerful. I mean, when I hear about those shootings and stuff, it's just, oh, I can't shake it.
Yeah.
I'm not any good to anyone. You know, it's like I can't even do my work, or, you know, so I try to shake it off. But in a way, she's right. You know, it's like, yeah, the Luther thing is cool, but what about the rest of the world? You know, so I try to listen a little bit. It's not something that comes easily to me, and it's not even something I necessarily want to do, but at some point I feel like I can't just keep my head down and stop trying to be eaten.
Yeah.
So that's the philosophical stuff that is really behind some of those other things I was saying. I still love this work. I wouldn't trade it for anything. It just always felt like I'm doing my best for the world by just being the person that I am. And so shutting myself away in my shop is fine. In some ways, that's true. I can, you know, I the love goes out through all of these musicians. It's incredible the amount of the power of that music that they're taking out into the world. And I get to be part of that. You know, the question I'm wrestling with is, okay, so is it time to, you know, is it time to peak, and what's going to happen if I do? What will I do then? Anyway, there you go.
Wow. Well, I was all set to retire the Fretboard Summit idea, but now you've got me invigorated that I need to get you and Ken Parker and Joe Glazer and maybe Skip Simmons, my aunt buddy, in the same room, and we can hammer out the world's problems. Yeah.
And Michael Dresner, see if you can get him in there too. Super smart guy.
We could do all that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we
put him on the list. So.
We started with Charo and we ended with school shootings. I don't know how that happened, but there was some guitar,
right.
There was some guitar talk right. There, and I'm so glad that you had the time to do this.
Well, I you know, any time for you, Jason. You are exceptional. I mean, there's just no one who does what you do, as I said before, and there's no one I feel like I could, you know, open up to like this publicly. I just can't imagine doing that with anyone else. So you make it easy.
Thank you. Thanks, TJ.
All right, man.
Get back to work. I'll do the same.
All right. Stay in touch, Jason. Right, talk soon.